हरिः ॐ सहना भवतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सरि गौर भक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे जय ओके सो देन परमात्मा संदर्भ अध्याय 4 आदिकारण 1 जीवस एंटेंगलमेंट एंड लिबरेशन. So now, page 7. So now we've discussed already the spiritual consciousness, the various levels of spiritual consciousness, because we have the Nitya Bada and the Nitya Siddha. So we've already discussed the liberated souls. So now, continuing now with the, how do you say, the Nitya Badas, what do you call the conditioned souls, right? Question, how many levels of material consciousness are there? Answer, there are three, right? So these are the main categories. Concealed consciousness, like trees and plants, means it's concealed. You don't even really can tell that it's there. Two, constricted consciousness, like animals and birds. So it's constricted because it's just they're only aware of eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. That's as far as they can see. They can't go beyond that. While the constricted, they don't even really see that. They see the six changes, you know, birth, growth, maintenance, a reproduction, dwindling, and death. That's the only thing that the plants and trees and plants can understand. While then the animals and constricted, they see that and eating, sleeping, mating, pending. All right. Then the third, budding consciousness, like human beings who are not yet spiritually awake. These three subcategories fall within the basic category of upadhi jiva. Souls living in a dream of false identity. This category is also known as Nityabhata Jiva or eternally conditioned souls. So in here is they, because all of these, they go by the upadhi. The tree thinks they're a tree. The animal thinks they're an animal. The human says, I'm this body. I'm from here. I'm from there. So they're all in the upadhi consciousness. So that's why then giving up upadhis means giving up these particular levels like that. Question. Okay, so basically in concealed, you have one level. In constricted, you have one level. You know, they're all like that. There might be some, a little bit more, a little bit less, depending on the modes that are functioning. Like you see some animals, maybe more in goodness, some more in passion, some more in ignorance, within ignorance. They're all within the mode of ignorance, but within that, there might be some more. Like a deer tends to be a little bit more in the mode of goodness. You know, like that koala bear seems to be a little bit more in ignorance, you know. So ISKCON joined. What does that mean? Like the whole world or? Okay. So then how many levels of budding consciousness are here? Answer, there are many different types. They may be roughly classified as six levels. So he's saying roughly, because within that, you'll always get these little fine combinations of this and that. But the rough levels are this. One, uncivilized tribes, right? So just those who just live on their own terms, they have their own scene. And so that's it. Two, civilized races with developed material knowledge and industrial capabilities, but who are ignorant of proper moral conduct and who have little faith in God. These are the characteristics of the Mlechas, the meat eaters. So basically that kind of like sums up your general Western society right there. Then three, civilized races that follow no personal God, but are very fond of the beauty of the material world. Buddhist culture provides an example of this, right? So they appreciate what's going on. They appreciate nature. They appreciate these things and all that kind of aspect like that. But but it's still not, there's no personal God. You know, there might be some aspect of supreme, but it'll be more like it'll be nature itself or like that. Four, civilized races that follow an imaginary God. They worship various demigods, thinking them to be supreme. and do good works in the hope of being promoted to the heavenly material planets where these demigods reside. This form of religion is called imaginary because they believe their conception of God to be the highest, though it is still only material, right? So they're still only dealing with the material concept of God. And so then, but they try to do good work and everything, and they try to elevate themselves to a heavenly position, which is still material. It's not a spiritual platform, right? Five, civilized races that accept the original transcendental person as the true supreme Lord, but who do not perform devotional service to him. And six, civilized races that are fond of Nirvishesh philosophy, the doctrine of impersonal oneness. Right. So we see is that there's going to be these, you know, also go in line with the four lower levels of consciousness, the Anamoy, Pranamoy, Manamoy, and Vijnanamoy. So as we see here is the sixth level, the civilized races are fond of Nirvishesh philosophy, the doctrine of impersonal. That will be the Vijnanamaya platform. Then you're going to have the civilized races that accept the original transcendental person as the true supreme Lord, but who do not perform devotional service to him. So then that will be your Manamoy, because they accept the Shastra, they worship the Lord and everything like that. Then you're going to see that the, civilized races that follow no personal God, but are fond of the beauty of the material world, like that. And then the civilized race that follow an imaginary God, they worship various demigods, that will be on the Pranamoy platform. Because they're simply, it's just about, you know, working together, doing good works, getting material benefits, and that's all they're thinking of. But all of it is created by themselves, like that. They're not themselves trying to, they're not following necessarily the scriptures and understanding that relationship with the Supreme properly. And then you see is that Anamoy will be then the uncivilized tribes and the civilized races with developed material consciousness and industrial capabilities, but who are ignorant of proper moral conduct and have little faith in God. These are the characteristics of the Mlechas, the meat eaters, right? Because they're a little more sophisticated, but they're still an Anamoy, right? Then you see in Pranamoy, those that, you know, it's about nature and living, and we're worried about the environment and eco and, you know, be nice, be good and all that. But it's not necessarily centered around the Lord like that. Then the next one is that the idea of God is there, but it's kind of imaginary. They make it up. They say what he is. You know, he's an old guy with a big beard and like that. And, you know, they just kind of make up that kind of thing, or they worship demigods, or, you know, they worship Ra, or, you know, something, who knows what they're doing. And, but their whole purpose is just do good works, be elevated to the higher regions where you'll enjoy yourself like that. But it's all in their own mind, because they think what they're doing is the highest. They don't know that there's anything beyond. They don't understand their position. Well, we can say in these the others, there'll also be that aspect, but they know that there's higher levels, that there's, you know, proper following the rules of the Shastra or renunciation and these kind of aspects. So they become very proud of it and they fight over it and there's all this kind of thing. At the same time, that's why he says roughly six levels. Third is Pranamoy, yeah. The lower level of Pranamoy. Fourth is the higher level of Pranamoy, like that. And then you also have the aspect of that when you talk about those who are, means you can also have a another kind of form, because he's giving that there's breakdowns. He says you have the immoral, how do you say, atheist, right? So that's one level. So that's the first two, right? Then you have the atheistic moralist, right? So that's basically this third one and the fourth, because they make up their own things like that. Then you have the theistic moralist, that they accept God's there, they accept God's laws and all that. So in that way, then you could say is like the Abrahamic and that, they would be classified in that way because they accept that there's a Lord and he has rules and they're supposed to follow those laws and all that. But at the same time, as they don't really have a proper understanding. They don't know about the Supreme Personality of Godhead and all that. Right. So it's kind of like it's kind of like in between. It has elements of both because they're only interested in the benefits that they'll get from their good work. But it's not necessarily they're following so strictly. The more strictly they come a little bit more this side, the less strictly they go a little bit more that side. Does that make sense? So that's why sometimes you'll see is that this, the fourth one here, sometimes it'll be classified within in the theistic and sometimes, you know, as here, not. But he's just asking the levels of consciousness. So it hasn't been specifically connected with the five levels, right? Good. Okay.
Maharaj, it seems in that presentation that only the one and two are meat eater and the other one are not meat eater.
They can be meat eaters. They can all be meat eaters. Why not? The ones who definitely wouldn't be would start with five. You know, three and four might not be, but it's not a necessary. Like there's so many people. I'm sure that there are many greenies who are not vegetarian.
Yes.
You know, mm-hmm. Buddhist culture, they accept like this, but except for the monks, no one else is vegetarian. Right. Some individuals may be, but as a rule, they don't. The monks are supposed to be, but everybody else not so much. But the first two definitely will be like that. But you might have some that aren't. But the point is that they just don't know what proper conduct and everything is. They may make up their own kind of things, you know, so that's why you see civilized like that. So they'll be sophisticated. They have developed material knowledge, industrial capabilities. So it's just about how to enjoy the senses, how to get the most. So we see is that even in the modern culture, that let's say you take, you know, you'll have those individuals that are using all this knowledge and sophistication, but they get the maximum for themselves and they couldn't care less for anybody else. And so it's not an uncommon feature, a theme in the modern culture. Like as they take modern culture, that you're civilized and material knowledge, industrial capabilities, technology, these kind of things. But they don't actually know what proper moral conduct is. They don't have that much faith in God. You know what I'm saying? You may ask that, but you know, what religion are you? Then they'll say some religion. But the point is when do they ever follow it? What restrictions are there? What kind of conduct is there due to religion? You know what I'm saying? You take your person on the street. How is their life? You know, they're getting up in the morning routine, they're eating, they're interacting with family, they're going to work, interacting there, their habits of cleanliness, their food habits, you know, all these things. What is regulated by moral conduct? You know, by religion or anything. So there's not really, you can't really say that there's much. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So in other words, you're seeing it in its more natural form here. And so there's going to be a lot more happening in Kali Yuga at the bottom, you know, like that. But that's why it says there's roughly there's six. Because within this, you can have different and some move this way or that way. Because like I said before, sometimes he just says it as, you know, you have the you know, when he'll say the consciousness and he'll count the animals and the anamoya, right, which they are. But they're in concealed and constricted consciousness, right? And then only humans, then it's budding. But the point is they're not taking advantage of it, right, until it starts to move up.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. And there's no personal God. It's just, you know, there's nature, there's this, there's the supreme. That's why then in this kind of group, you know, they may be at the yoga studio, they're new agey, you know, all those kind of things like that. You know? And then these civilized have an imaginary God, then, you know, that's the problem, is that everyone gets into their own idea. You know, they're arguing over, is God's white or black? Is he a woman or a man? Or this and that. So, you know, you're dealing with it's not really, they don't have an idea of who God is. Right? They're not learning from scriptures. They have their own opinion. So you can say is with this fifth level, then they're accepting the scriptures.
Yes.
Right. But at the same time, you could also say, that means if you're taking the world, but you can also say within the Vedic, the civilized accept the original supreme personality as the true supreme Lord, but do not perform service to him. That means the people who actually know who he is, you know, like Dhritarashtra or someone like that, he knows Krishna is the original supreme personality of Godhead. So many in the Vedic culture, they know that. So that means any other thing where they're worshiping demigods or any other concept other than the actual what it is, and they understand this original supreme person, then that puts them down into that fourth level. So in one sense, world religions would be counted within the fourth level, you know, along with all the demigod worshippers and this and that and all these kinds of laws like that, because they accept. But the point problem is God's part of their morality, not that their morality is part of their God consciousness. That's where you see the switch. So therefore you could count them as theistic, but at the same time as they don't really know what theism is. That's why it's called imaginary. And you also have those who are, you know, the lower end of that, who are not actually interested in religion, but they've found that people in general are. And if people in general are religious, they tend to behave better. You know, just like I think it was, I'm not sure when it was, but, you know, in some years recently in the past, then, you know, this move for the secular education to the point where there's no religious education at all in the schools. They don't even talk about religion, nothing, you know. But then they found the character of the children just started to go down. So now, at least in some countries and that, they've introduced religious education as one of the subjects. So, but it's not that they're teaching any one particular, it's just that they're exposing the children to the concept of religion. And so then, you know, various individuals will come and then, you know, make some kind of presentation, take the kids through things and stuff like that. And so, you know, in some countries, we also are invited to come and teach, you know, like once a week, we come and do a thing on the, you know, what the Vedic culture is. Someone else will do, you know, other religions like that. And so, or it is that they come and they teach at that time, and then the children can choose which one they want to go to,
yes.
You know, like this. But whatever it is, they've seen that it's important for morality. So in other words, if you have God, morality goes better. So that's this fourth level, is that they don't really care about God so much. They just see that by having it as part of the thing, then life goes better. But not that they necessarily have so much faith or so much interest, right? Like that, they could even be part of the third one, right? If they're more like that sentimental, trying to, you know, everybody together and we all this. So if it's a little more new age, it'll go to the third. If there's more of a concept organized or whatever it is, that'll go to the fourth.
Yes.
You understand? So. Right? Does that make sense? So then this fourth one would have an element of manomoy and pranamoy. So one has to be. Yes, we're good?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Question.
I think
is there a... A. So you're saying A levels or O levels or like that kind of? You have to go through A levels to get to the O level. Like, okay. Is there a level that a soul must pass through to go from the eternally conditioned state to the internally liberated state? Answer. From the Nitya Bhada or eternally conditioned level, the soul must rise to the Bhada Mukta level, at which the soul lives in the material world but is not caught up in Maya, illusion. From the Mukta, from Bhada Mukta level, the soul may rise to the Nitya Mukta, eternally liberated level, which is the level of Sarup Jiva, soul situated in the reality of their own eternal forms, right? So here's the aspect of that Bhada Mukta. That's that, you know, before we also mention this as the fortunate soul, is that they're fortunate and that they've come across the actual process to transfer from the material consciousness to the spiritual. And then by practicing that, as they go from Sakam Karma Yoga to Nishkam Karma Yoga, then they're able to rise above the material illusion, and then they can come to pure bhakti. Question, are there different types of Bhada Mukta Jivas? Answer, there are two types. One, those with blooming consciousness, because we saw there's budding consciousness with all those others. So that means even the impersonalist, it's only budding consciousness, like that. Those with blooming consciousness, like the practicing devotees, sadhana bhaktas who serve Krishna by following the rules of the scriptures. And two, those with fully flowering consciousness, like the devotees who experience spiritual ecstasy while executing scriptural duties. Right? So that means then if someone's situated nicely in devotional service, then he comes into this Bhada Mukta Jiva. That's what he's saying. The devotees are liberated because they're on that platform, but there's still that conditioning. There's still a little bit, you know, they have to give up and with practice, just give up that habit of dealing on the material platform, right, with those attachments and those interests. So then that will bring it from blooming, and then when it comes to pure devotional service, and then one is developing that spiritually, that'll be flowering.
Maharaj, it yes. Seems that there are Vaidhi sadhakas and Raganuga sadhakas.
You could say like that. I would think that would be there, or just those who come up to the platform of Bhava, because even if they are Vaidhi, but they're on the platform of Bhava, means for us, that would be what it would mean. But let's say for the Vaikunthawalas, they can still be Vaidhi, but they would be coming to the flowering consciousness. Does that make sense? So they haven't gotten to Prem yet. You know, they haven't come across to Nitya like that. So that means then that element that's there, you can say is that from, you could say from the aspect of Ruchi, you know, through Bhava, you could say is that'll be kind of like you're developing like that of the flowering consciousness. And that Ruchi and Asakti would be the place where the blooming would start to go into the flowering. Right? But basically, you can say there's blooming and this flowering only with devotees, only with Vaishnavas. So even though you may have these great sages and everything like that, they're only in budding consciousness, because actual consciousness means being aware of your relationship with the Lord and acting in that. That's actual. So even though they may be very elevated within the material context, it still doesn't mean that there's a whole lot going on. When you come to the spiritual, it's like when you look at the universe, you see is that you have, you know, in the universe, you have Bhumandala, and then you have all the different planetary systems up to, what do you call it, Indraloka. Then you have all that in there, right?
Yes.
Then from there, then you have, you know, Mahar, Jhana, Tapa, Satya.
Yes.
Everything else, that's within this. And then everything else is also within this.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like that is that these six that are mentioned there within budding, that's going to be still all just budding. It may be finer levels of budding. It's getting closer to this, what do you call it, blooming. But it still is not blooming unless they understand their relationship with the Lord. It's just the way it is. Because we have to understand it starts with Krishna as a person. It doesn't start with the impersonal. If it starts with the impersonal, then we're going to say, yeah, it's very elevated. And then there's the personal after. No, it starts with the personal. The impersonal is just the effulgence of Krishna's bodily rays. You know, that's what you're dealing with here. So then that's why we were mentioning before is that the devotees, they'll situate themselves in Vijnanamaya, means on the platform of the soul, because they're still conditioned. So they're this Bada Mukta jeeves, right? So they're liberated, what do you call it? That, let's see. They lives the material, but it's not caught up in Maya. So they're going to start there. That's going to be their natural platform. And from there, they come into that Shuddha Sattva and move into the Anandamaya. Right? Because the spiritual world is known as Shuddha Sattva. Right? That's the point, is that that's the situation. So from being situated here, you become situated there. Right? So you're rendering service here, then you come to that platform, you render service there. So it still continues. It doesn't change. That doesn't change. Right? Is that?
Yes,
yeah. So that's why in these, because you're looking at different aspects, you're looking at the Bada Jiva, so the consciousness is all like this. But if it means like you see, follow no person, found of the beauty of the material world and now that, or, you know, they're trying to liberate themselves. These, so they're using different aspects of budding consciousness as that's the aspect of the Bada, right? Because it's Bada Mukta. So whatever it is, they'll be situated in the Vijnana Moy, but there might be the flavors of these other lower levels to them. You know? So, but that's their situation and their endeavor, they're trying to get to the higher platform of Anandamaya. Right, of that pure service to Krishna. Does that make any sense?
No,
yeah.
Okay. This Vada Mukta Jiva, they are all in contact with devotee.
They are devotees.
Okay.
This, it says here the sadhana bhaktas.
Yes. Yeah.
Says there are two types. What are the Bada Mukta Jivas, right? Because you've taken it up. So then above these six of the condition, the budding consciousness, then above that, then there's because those are all Nitya Badas, right? Then you have to, so is there a level to go through to get to this trend? So in other words, we're at the Nitya Bada stage. And we have these six levels of consciousness.
Yes.
Right? Or six categories, you can say. In four levels, of course, but six categories. Then you're going to have the Nitya Muktas. How do we get from one to the next? Is there something to go between? So that's the Bada Mukta. So in the Bada Mukta, then you're going to have the blooming consciousness and the flowering consciousness. Like that. So they're both devotees. So the blooming is those who blooming, like the practicing devotees, sadhana bhaktas, who serve Krishna by following the rules of scripture. And those are fully flat, like the devotees experience spiritual ecstasy while executing spiritual duties. So yes, it'll be that aspect there. But you could also say is that blooming can also be the level of the upper level of that can be the Raganuga Bhaktas, but still within sadhana. Then those who have come into the platform of bhava, they would be the flowering.
Yes.
Right? Does that make sense? So you're always going to have, you have one position, the other, and something in between. So one in between, depending upon if it's more this way, you count it like this. If it's more that way, you count it like that.
Yes.
But you see the two, and then you judge where it is in between. Does that make sense? You know, it's like, this. Is this Okay, you have this one. No, let's see. This one.
Yes.
Okay.
Different color.
What color is that?
It's red, gray.
Yeah, and then what's this one?
White.
Yeah, but it's still red.
Yes.
But there's more white, and this one has less white in it.
Yes.
But then it also, like you said, has some blue. Well, this one up here, then you see less blue.
Yes.
But you'll call them all red.
Yes.
So basically you're giving the main area, because that's why it says basically there's this. So from this, then you can understand in between the mixes and this and that. So that's why you have to use the intelligence. You can't just go, oh, but it doesn't say this. But that's where you're supposed to use your brain. Right? Does that make sense? Question. Where do the Nitya Bada, Bada Mukta and Nitya Mukta souls reside? Answer. The Nitya Bada and Bada Mukta souls reside in the material world. The Nitya Mukta souls reside in the spiritual world. Vaikuntha, the place of no anxiety. Vaishnava Siddhanta Mala, chapter 7. Right? So in other words, if you're still, that's why you're saying here is you can have those on the Uttama platform, on the platform of Bhava, but they're still here. They're still residing here. So they haven't come to the platform of Prema. Right? So once they come to the point of Vastu City, then they switch from this world to that world. Does that make sense? It means when they're rendering their service within their mind, they are there, but the body's still here. And so then they may come back and forth. So when they come to Vastu City, simply means you don't go back. Does that make sense? Like that. So from this side, we'll say they left. You know, they left means, you know, they don't come back. Does that make sense? Well, here is that someone may be here, and then in their own sadhana and time, they'll be absorbed in the Lord's pastimes, and then they'll be here and then interact and all that. Right? But once someone comes to the platform, the Nitya Mukta, then even if that soul comes here, they're not technically here. You know, as pointed out, they only see the Lord's spiritual energy. They don't see anything else. Yeah? Okay. Vritti. Having concluded that the Supreme Lord creates the universe by his natural Maya Shakti, and that the bewildered Jiva can destroy the Ahankar by the realization of the faultless Lord, the author further affirms this conclusion in the next few Anuchetas by citing the conversation of Vidura and Maitreya Muni in the third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, where Vidura inquires from the sage whether the Lord is subjected to the influence of Maya when he appears in this world. Anucheta 85. The following is the view of one group. The Supreme Lord has two Shaktis, Sarup Shakti and Maya Shakti. The Sarup Shakti reveals the powers of the Lord. The Maya Shakti shows the creation of the universe to the Jivas bewildered by its illusory powers. Footnote 1, Udriti. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakura elaborates on this point in Jiva Dharma as follows. Vrajanath, what is the Vedic understanding of the marginal situation known as Tathasta? Raghunathas Babaji. The borderline between water and land is called Tata. Yet the water is contiguous to the land. Where is the Tata, the margin? The Tata is merely the demarcation that separates the water from land. This Tata is a very subtle state. It cannot be perceived through mundane vision. From this allegory, we take the water as the spiritual world and the land as the material world. And thus the fine line that divides the two is the Tata. The subtle demarcation exactly whereupon the Jiva soul is located. Then, okay. The countless atomic particles, because it used to be on the next page or something. Okay.
It might have got changed while last moment I'm keeping adding, subtracting something.
Okay. The countless atomic particles that float in the rays of the sun give an inkling of the real position of the jiva. In one direction, the jiva sees the spiritual universe, and in the other, he sees the phenomenal world created by Lord Brahma, the world of Maya. The chit shakti of the Supreme Lord is unlimited, and the Maya shakti is enormous. Positioned exactly between the two are the innumerable jivas. They are products of Sri Krishna's tathasta shakti, and hence by nature, the jiva is marginal. Because you're always going to have the two, like when you have land and you have water, there's going to be that place in between. And so that is also, you see, that place is you have direct land, right? That's going to be the area where that's the material. And we saw those levels of budding consciousness, constricted or covered consciousness, right? Then you're going to have the ocean, the water, that's going to be the nitya siddhas, right? Then that place where you see the water is coming and it's wet, but at the same time it's land, that's going to be the place of the bada muktas. So depending upon their position, they're more towards the water or more towards the land. With that, does that make sense? Yeah. So as it mentions here, it's subtle. So it's that fine line. It's that line. So, well, where is the line? The point is it's a fine line. You know, that's the point, is we want a gross definition of something that's subtle. You know, so that's the difficulty, is that it's got to be gross enough that it matches with whatever our level of gross logic is. And then only we say it is bona fide. But then that kind of stuff, we're struggling with these things of our imaginary ideas, our ideas, you know? And so God has to fit into our idea. So we can see is that contamination is that lower level of consciousness. It's actually within the budding, not within the blooming consciousness. Blooming is positive moving forward. The budding means you still have that connection in the back. You know, so as devotees, they'll naturally be, there's going to be, everybody's going to have their particular anartas. So you just have to see this is one of the more popular ones, is that they have to be able to fit it within their anuman. So it's imaginary. No, it's just, there it is. It's the line between, right? Because the point is, you know, the night and the day, where's the twilight? You know, is this and that, is a day, is a night, but it's the whole, that whole range. You know, so wherever it is at the time, that's where the line is. Vrajanath, what is the tatastha swabhava, marginal nature? Raghunath Das Babaji, the jiva is situated in the middle with access to both worlds, and he is constitutionally susceptible to come under the control of either of the shaktis. This condition is symptomatic of the tatastha swabhava. When the movement of river water shifts the bank of the river, this seizes the land and converts it into riverbed. Alternatively, silt may deposit into embankments, which then gradually become land. Similarly, if the jiva looks towards Sri Krishna, his faith in Krishna increases and he develops a stronger foothold in the spiritual realm. However, he looks at Maya and turns his back to Sri Krishna, he thereby becomes enmeshed in the network of Maya. This choice is the natural characteristic of tatastha swabhava, right? So here is that we want this exact line, but we're dealing with the swabhava and nature. And so like it says, the river is there. What's river is river and what's bank is bank. But what you see is that the river may come and take part of the bank, or it may, in areas of where water is there, then more silt will have that and they'll become land. So that's the point. There's a point in between, but that doesn't happen out in the middle. It happens right on the edge between the two. So that ability to, the what's there at the land goes into the water goes into the land. That's the whole point, is that one can, if one looks towards the land, one goes into the land, the silt. One looks towards the water, then one becomes part of the water. So that's the point. We have the ability to work under either one of these two energies. We're susceptible to that because we're so small. That's our nature. you know, no use complaining about the nature, you know, you embrace that nature, that's the way it is, and be absorbed in Krishna, you get all the benefits. Right? Does that make sense? Vrajanath, is the Maya Shakti in some way present in the constitutional structure of Jiva? Raghunath Das Babaji, no, the Jiva is a product of spiritual nature. However, because he is infinitesimal in size, he lacks sufficient spiritual strength. Therefore, he is vulnerable and can be easily defeated by Maya, although Maya is actually totally absent in the constitution of the Jiva. Jiva Dharma, chapter 15. So that means it's not inherent in the Jiva, therefore it's not a natural position. Well, he is why that's the natural position to be in. So then in the spiritual world, he'll be satisfied. In the material world, he can never be satisfied. So that's basically what you're dealing with. So that's why then the living entity has to be come to the position of the transcendental nature. That makes sense. So it's very straightforward like that. But it's just a matter of just being comfortable that, yeah, that's the way it is. These are all up for a discussion of the definition. No, the definition is there. It's just a matter of us being able to appreciate it and being able to take advantage of that understanding or knowledge of the Jiva, right? And their relationship with the Lord. Okay. Then it continues. Okay. Because of this Maya, a single person endowed with various types of knowledge performs actions in the world. This is not the perception of the Dvaitins, since in this philosophy, an object, universe, is revealed by a real agent, Lord, to a real seer, Jiva, by a real Shakti, Maya Shakti, let that be. So because they have their own idea of how that is, we're not going to get involved in that, right? So then an example, why waste time speculating whether the fragrance of Krishna's lotus feet is real or unreal, whether the universe is real or unreal? You know, what's the point? One should understand the truth of a real world as stated in Srimad Bhagavatam 10.87.36 by accepting Sridhar Swami's commentary, since he concludes that non-different exists in this world. Some conclude that he also infers non-difference of Vaikuntha and other objects, no variety in Brahman. We can confirm the qualities of an object capable of worldly perception by examples of other objects proved by perception. However, what is not subject to worldly perception can only be understood by persons who know scriptures, and this cannot be changed at any time. Right? So we may have that aspect of the seeing things of this world, and by dealing with things of this world, then we're going to be analyzing things in that way. And we can also use those examples to give an idea of the spiritual platform. But the point is the spiritual platform can be only revealed from the spiritual platform. It's descending knowledge. So it can't be approached by art. We can apply our analytical ability to understanding the knowledge, but it's not that analytical process will reveal the knowledge, right? That's the important point. You know, we can engage it because that's what we're doing, just like we can engage the body, mind, and words in the Lord's service. So that means why the analytical process can't be engaged. But in that engagement, then only that relationship with the Lord can be understood if that descends by the Lord's mercy. But if we're using the body, the mind, the words nicely in Krishna's service, Krishna reveals. It doesn't matter. Someone's just doing some cleaning work, he realizes Krishna. Someone's doing analytical work, they realize Krishna. Right? So it doesn't matter. The point is that you are engaging yourself in Krishna's service, Krishna being pleased, then he reveals himself. So therefore, why speculate so much on what's real, what's not real here? Because it's been stated what it is, how it works, that it's real. But at the same time, if you see it not connected with Krishna, and you think it's permanent, or you think that it will give you satisfaction, that is unreal. So in other words, it exists, but our perception may be real or unreal. And so since our perception is what makes things concrete for us, that's why we say it's unreal, because in the concrete, it's not real to us, right? The Advaitins are moving through the world and they don't bump into things, right? You know, but at the same time as they don't consider it's real, because in their consciousness, it's not important. So that's why it's not so much of a main point. It means we'll deal with them on it. But for ourselves, that's not the main point that we want to appreciate. What we want to appreciate is that when things are seen in context of Krishna, then they take on their actual reality. And when they're seen not in context with Krishna, they exist and they are part of Krishna, but we don't see that. That's where the illusion is. Yeah? Okay. In establishing that the jiva and the Lord are non-different, the non-difference means they both have conscious forms, right? That's the whole point that's being done there. Udriti. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes the principle of simultaneous oneness and difference between the Lord and the jiva and the jiva dharma as follows. Vrajanath. If the eternal difference is perfectly and conclusively proved, when and how does the principle of non-difference become an active principle? Furthermore, if this principle of eternal non-difference actually does not become active, shall we have to accept ultimately the concept of nirvana, jiva merging into Brahman? Raghunath, right? Because you have difference and non-difference. You establish one, does that mean the other one's not functioning? You know, if that one functions, does this mean this one doesn't function? Raghunath Das Babaji, you understand what's happening here? It means, let's say we have Dwait Advait. That means Dwait's working, Advait you're not dealing with. You know, or you're dealing with Advait, Dwait's not working. So I can look at both of these things. But I say, Achinta Beda Beda Tattva is simultaneously and inconceivably, both are active and both are passive. Like that. That's the uniqueness. That's why it becomes a little bit more confusing. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Raghunath Das, no, my dear son. That is emphatically not the case, right? So he's saying no, and he's saying emphatically. At no stage does the jiva become non-different from the Supreme Lord. Raghunath, yet did you not say that they are inconceivably and simultaneously one and different? Raghunath Das Babaji, on the basis of his spiritual nature and qualities, the jiva is eternally non-different from Krishna, right? Spiritual nature and qualities, that he's spiritual and he has the qualities like Krishna. That way, then, he is non-different. But on the grounds of his spiritual identity, the jiva is eternally distinct from Krishna, right? Means like you're saying you have, you know, the qualities of something, his spiritual situation, the qualities, that's where you're going to say they're the same. But as far as identity, each one has their own identity. There's not going to be a different, there's not going to be a sameness there. So that's what the Mayavadis are trying to do, is say we're the same in identity, you know, but at the same time as we're Brahman that can be covered. So that means if any part of Brahman could be covered, then at any time, you know, we would lose that position or that identity. So it's not a good approach. Like that, right? Their oneness is eternal and their distinction is also eternal. And the aspect of eternal distinction between them is preeminent and conspicuous, right? The distinction is the prominence. The oneness is there so that you can take advantage of the difference. And the difference is there, it's only working because of the oneness. Does that make sense? Let's say I have a hammer and a tomato. Right? So, because there's not a oneness, the difference can't be applied. Right? But if I, let's say, I have a hammer and a nail, they're different, but that can be applied together. You know what I'm saying? So that's the thing, is you have to appreciate that these two principles are eternal, but the emphasis is on the identity. The other is just the situation. The oneness is just the situation. In other words, the oneness is the tattva. The difference, that's the rasa.
Also, can we say yes. Oneness? Because of oneness, there is a relationship that is established, and then
in order to act,
then there should be difference.
There should be the difference, yes. Because the oneness establishes the relationship, because unless there's a oneness, how can you have a relationship? Right? Means only those who have common qualities can be friends, have a relationship. Right? And so then there's going to be the difference is going to be then as an individual within that context of oneness. Right? So that becomes the prominent element. The oneness is just actually just the situation. And then the difference is then how they act. But at the same time is that mood can be so intense, like you see with Krishna and the gopis, that they feel that sense of oneness and identity. But they're two. It's, in other words, it's two feeling the identity of one. That becomes the uniqueness. So they always go together. Prabhu had something, or he disappeared.
He'll be back.
He'll be back. Okay. Very good. Okay. So the eternal and the aspect of eternal distinction between them is preeminent and conspicuous. For example, one may say, this house is the property of Devadatta. Simultaneously, one may also state, Devadatta is not present in the house. Of the two simultaneously correct statements, the fact that the house is the property of Devadatta is clearly the preeminent statement of the two. Another example from the material world is the visible sky. It is an inert matter and has a source. But in spite of its having oneness with its source, the generic outer space, the visible sky is self-evident by its distinction from its source, outer space. In fact, its identity is discerned by this actual distinction from its source. Thus, the eternal difference of the jiva from the Supreme Lord, in spite of his simultaneous eternal oneness with the Supreme Lord, actually bestows upon the jiva his eternal identity and is thus the most important aspect of their eternal relationship. So that the oneness that establishes relationship, but that difference is the most important aspect of it, because if they're different, you act. But if they're only one, then what's the need to act? Right. Yes, sir.
All right, so I'm just trying to understand in terms of cause and effect, it seems that there's no relationship in as a cause and effect, the oneness and the difference, they just eternally coexist. Is that yes. correct?
Yes, they coexist. That means you can say is that the difference is based on the oneness. So you could say in one way, it's the manifestation is of the difference is coming from the oneness, right? But at the same time is, the whole point of the difference is then you can express that oneness, right? In other words, it's just like, remember before we were talking about the, what was it? Can't remember the English terms, but basically you're saying, It's to do with the ness that Krishna's position, that primal position, is the basis. But without, but without, and because he's the basis, then his energy has that basis. But he is manifest through his energy. The same time, the energy doesn't have a separate existence than that original nature. Do you remember what that those words were?
Well, I remember that when we discuss the qualities of the Lord and the energies of the Lord, then we establish that the qualities of the Lord manifested by the energies of the Lord, but his action is based on his qualities, means he's using his energies according to his qualities. So that's what I remember.
Yeah, because activities will be based on qualities. Yeah, because see, that's the whole point, is they're inherently one, but at the same time, they're different. That's the whole point of this whole approach. But what we're saying is because you can say the oneness aspect is important, that you understand, see everything from the transcendental position and everything in relationship to Krishna. But at the same time, it's the difference that he's saying is the preeminent aspect, because that's where then the relationship then is expressed and tasted. So rasa is tasted in the difference. Like we said, Krishna is one as rasa, but he's also many. So as one, he's encompassing everything as coming under within his rasa. Right, that mood of encompassing everything, that is one flavor. But at the same time, is that it has its own unique rasa. That difference, then that is where you get pastimes, because then the Lord in his position interacts, because he is everything. So somebody interacts with him in rasa according to that position, that aspect he interacts. Right. And so then that makes that's where rasa is experienced. That's where the pastimes are experienced. Yeah.
Yes, Maharaj. Also, when we discuss the different schools, the philosophical schools, we can see that the Shankara, he takes it, all the way to absolute oneness. Right. And then Madhva, he says, no, absolute difference.
Yes.
And, well, the modified oneness of Ramanuja, still right. We can see the shift is to oneness. It's not about so much differences. It's about oneness, but it's modified oneness. But then only in Nimbarka, we see the balance, which is Svabhaviki Beda Abeda. And then the absolute balance is the Mahaprabhu's philosophy, which is simultaneous, inconceivable, oneness and difference. So there's a progression there. But I guess we have to go through the steps, otherwise it's not obvious. I mean, we say it easily, but it's not that obvious.
Yes, because the thing is if you're talking about the greatness of the Lord and all that, then there's going to be an emphasis on how everything is the Lord, and everything then has its position in that. So you're going to see that aspect of oneness is going to be very prominent, but there's also a difference because they're a devotee like this. But as you get into the more, you add more sweetness, then you add in the difference becomes a little bit more prominent, right? But if you take it too much to the difference, then what's the basis of the relationship? There's the sweetness from that side? Because either way you look at it, they both have each other, but then one will be prominent. Does that make sense? So that's why it becomes sometimes difficult to understand, because we're looking at things that it should be. This is what it is, and this one is that. But the problem is then there's always the thing in here, you know? And so there's always going to be these overlaps and everything like that, and one the other is that without the, in other words, you have the masculine aspect and the feminine aspect. The masculine is there, but without the feminine, it's not manifest. But the feminine doesn't have a position without the masculine, right? The Shakti and the Shaktiman. Does that make sense? Like that. It's funny, I can't remember those words. Because they end with ness, N-E-double-S. Yeah. No idea. So then we'll see is what it is that they're bringing out. What's the particular flavor? So that's why there will be these flavors. So even in the spiritual world, there'll be the flavors of where they're focusing, where they're emphasizing and all that. And so that'll give the various tastes that are there. Sorry.
Well, actually, if we look at Madhva's philosophy, that for Dasya, it supports actually that you are the servant and he is the Lord. So there's you know, quite a bit of distance between the servant and the master. So yes, it doesn't have to be like super close relationship.
Yeah. And then from that position, because of the difference, then you render service because he's God and you're small. He's unlimited. You're small. And then Ramanuja is bringing out more the aspect of, you know, because of that the elements that are one, that's why you're inspired to then serve. So one is you're inspired because of the difference. The other, you're inspired because of the commonality. You know, because one also has to appreciate Ramanujacharya is an unksha of Sesha. And so Sesha is non-different from the Lord, but at the same time, it's different. But so he'll have more of that aspect of the sameness. You know, like Balaram, we'll be seeing more of the sameness. Like that. But they serve. Yeah. So it's just a matter of the flavor of the particular acharya. But these different personalities took up these aspects to bring out because there's a purpose to be established. Right. So we see is that Nimbarkas is the first one to be established. So that's closer. I think that's even either in the very beginning of Kali Yuga or in the very end of Dwapara, you know, right on that border there. It'll be in the Sandhi in any case. And so then you can have closer to the actual Veda, you know, the full Vedic philosophy. Then you have the what do you call it? What is it? Vishishta Vishuddha, the purified oneness. Yeah, with the purified oneness. So he'll be back quite a long ways. But I'm not sure where his position is in connection with, let's say, the Buddha. You know, because at one point, then they have to be taken off track because they're just getting too weird. And so bringing them back, then the Vishishta Dvait means if there's Vishuddha Dvait, you know, is being brought in to kind of like deal with them. But then they get off track. It's natural they're going to come back into Vishishta Dvait, right? They went out at Vishuddha Dvait, so they're going to come back at Vishishta Dvait. And then those who don't come back in, then you're going to deal Dvait, you know? Then you can, once you've cleared all that, then it's into Veda Veda Tattva. So it's good? Yes? No? Moto Moti.
Yes, I think that because Nimbarka was before Shankara, that
right.
His position is, I mean, his philosophy, it's not based actually on answering Shankara's, you know.
Yes.
Wait, so yes. It's more objective, and he says it's natural, svabhaviki. And then, you know, he gives an example like Amsha and the Amsha, they are different, but they are non-different. Or like wave and the ocean, that's his example.
Hmm.
Yes. You can't say the wave is not the ocean, but you can't say the ocean. So he's more objective, but those who came after Shankara, they had to, you know, it's his, you know, philosophy. So it puts it in a different perspective.
Yes, yes. Yeah, different, yes. So, but there also you see is that it's not bringing in that simultaneous oneness and difference. So it's you look at it this way, you look at it that way, and you see that's what goes on in Dwarka, in Lower Goloka. You know, or in goal, you know, depending on how you're looking, then that whole, you know, Dwarka, Mathura kind of whole scene, they look at the Lord as just their, you know, relative, or they look at him as the Supreme Lord. So they do both of them, but not simultaneously. They do one or the other. So they don't have a problem with both. And so that will, in other words, that philosophy will get you into Goloka, but only a Chintabheda Veda Tattva will get you into Braja, right? Because then they're seeing that difference and oneness at the same time. Is because they're difference, then they feel that oneness of the mood, you know, or because of the oneness, they can be the difference. Otherwise, how do you get? Remember, we read all the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Lord Chaitanya was explaining all those different kinds of jalpa, right? So much in there, then they're criticizing the lover in different ways. And so then in that, how can you criticize unless there's a feeling, in affection, unless there's a feeling of oneness? You know, it's just like sometimes you do something and you call yourself an idiot. You know, but you like yourself, you know, because there's the oneness, therefore you can point out the difference. Does that make sense? At the same time, because there's a difference, then you can point out the oneness. Does that make sense? So when they're separated, they're trying to come together. When they're together, then they point out the difference. Does that make sense? They both go together. So the Sambhog and the Viparlamba, They're the oneness and difference simultaneously. Does that make sense?
Yes, that's why in the Nimbarka's philosophy, when Radhika and Krishna, they always together, it has a tinge of Aishwarya, because it's unnatural for humans to be always together, like you know, Nitya Milan. It's kind of unnatural.
Yeah, it means we see it in the deity worship, right? Radha and Krishna are always together in the deity worship.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so that, of course, then places it within a particular context. But because they're dealing with Radha and Krishna pastimes, but they're dealing within that context. So that's why that's then described as Lower Goloka. So there is Vrindavan where these things going on. So even when Ramanuja, you know, the Alwars, and they're talking about like Andal and that about the gopis and this and that, but they're not, Radharani doesn't feature so prominent, but it has that element of like you said, of Aishwarya to it, that greatness and all that. And so it becomes part of the aspect so that they appreciate the Vrindavan pastimes, but they appreciate it from their angle. That Supreme has done such wonderful things, right? From Ramanuja's side, but from then Nimbarka's, then you know Krishna will be the original. But at the same time, as it has that little bit of formality to it. Like you said, they're always together, because if there's no separation, then you don't have that intensity. And so then it's always going to be wonderful and nice and everything like that. But when you throw in, so it's always going to be stable and steady. And because they're always together, it's almost like it's Swakia, but it's a Parakia environment. Right? So how high will the ecstasy go? Right? So that's the point. It can get in Anubhava or in the first state of Rudha Mahabhav. It can't get into Adhirudha Mahabhava. right? Because of the thing of always being together and all that. But the thing is once you throw in the aspect of the separation and all that, now you can go into the this higher level. Is that, yeah, because they don't have separation because they don't want to experience that intensity. But, you know, because it'll also have that element of that they want to be part of that and experience like that, and which is fine. That's their taste. But then you see as Radharani's mood is that whatever makes Krishna happy, even if that makes us unhappy, then that is our happiness. So that level of service, that level of surrender, that then is something unique that the others don't explain. They don't bring one to. Right. So that's yeah. Okay. Yeah, okay. So, okay. Okay, so read that last sentence. Thus, the eternal difference of the jiva from the Supreme Lord, in spite of a simultaneous eternal oneness with the Supreme Lord, actually bestows upon the jiva his eternal identity and is thus the most important aspect of their eternal relationship. Right? But the point is they too have to be there at once. That's why for us, it says because of their, in spite of his simultaneous eternal oneness, that's where the commonality, that's the basis. That's like the Dham. It's the place in which the pastimes take place, but it's the difference that makes the pastimes. It's the oneness that gives the situation, but it's the difference that creates the pastime. Because it's the oneness, it's just going to be Krishna's rasa. But it's the difference, now it's going to be the other devotees. That'll be the pastimes. Right? So they both are there. You can't have one without the other. Like that. So, okay, how are we doing on time? Okay. Brajanath, kindly tell me more about the eternal nature of the jiva. Raghunath Das Babaji. The jiva is an infinitesimal spiritual entity endowed by his very nature with consciousness. Thus he has knowledge. He possesses self-identity, is an enjoyer, a thinker, and an intelligent being. The jiva is the proprietor of an eternal identity, which is extremely esoteric and subtle. The material human body is made up of limbs, ears, nose, etc. Similarly, the spiritual body of the jiva is embellished with perfect spiritual features, and this is his eternal form. When the jiva becomes conditioned, two upadis, false identities, cover his atomic eternal spiritual form. The first cover is his linga sharir, the subtle body, and the second covering is stula sharir, gross physical body. Right? So his very nature is consciousness and knowledge, self-identity, enjoyer, thinker, and intelligent being. So all these things are his inherent nature, but if he turns his, like from what was previously said, if he turns his attention towards, away from Krishna, then he becomes covered by the material energy, then he gets these upadis. But if he turns towards Krishna, he doesn't have these upadis, he has his natural nature. Yeah. Good. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Shri Prabhupada ki.